Welcome back, everybody. And again, thank you so much for being here. As I said at the top of the hour, I am always surprised that people show up when there's a substitute teacher for Peter. And so I appreciate that so much. And Peter has asked me to talk tonight on the life of the Buddha up to the point of his enlightenment. And I kind of thought, well, that'll be easy. We've all heard there's so many somewhat apocryphal stories about his early life and his upbringing and even the time period of his wandering as an ascetic, right up to the stories about Mara coming and attacking him as he was sitting underneath the Bodhi tree. I'm not going to tell you tonight any of those apocryphal stories because you've heard them all. And I've got new material, I think, to share with you, because I found in doing my research, there was a lot of stuff that I did not understand, not so much in the events of his life, but in the formation of his yoga, of his unique and particular form of teaching. And that's kind of what I want to focus on tonight, is what I learned from doing the research. And I have a list someplace for you of the texts that I used. I used the Thich Nhat Hanh text called Old Path, White Clouds. I also used three different books by Karen Armstrong, who has written this book called The Great Transformation, The Beginning of Religious Traditions, and this one, The History of God. And she also wrote a history of Buddha. And I read several biographies of the Buddha too. But these books, Karen Armstrong and Thich Nhat Hanh, as well as some research documents that I found on Wikipedia, are my primary sources here. And if you want to know those texts, I'll send you that information. I want to begin by, let me get my glasses on here, because I want to begin by doing a screen share and giving you a sense of the timeline. So give me a second here. Can you see this timeline I have here?
Yep.
Yes. Okay. So I want to do a little history lesson here. So bear with me if you're not interested in history. I think you might be interested in this. But there are some things that are very, very confusing about doing this kind of research. And one is the whole issue of time and documentation. I have to tell you, I have really lost some faith in any kind of fact that you may want to try to say about the life of somebody who lived 2,600 years ago when things were not written down. There were no documentarians living at the time, you know, keeping records of things. But we do have these amazing text discourses that were carried on by orally, but not written down until after the Common Era, you know, so maybe 300 to 400 years after the Buddha's death before they were even written down. So I'm looking at everything, and also all the dates I have, even for dates of his birth and death, I can give you several different authoritative resources that give you different dates. Still, I'm going to go ahead and I wanted to start with giving you this timeline because I thought it would be helpful. And so what you're seeing here is the Vedic tradition, which is the spiritual tradition that the Buddha was born into. Gautama, I'm not going to refer to him as the Buddha until he's enlightened, okay? So Siddhartha Gautama was born kind of in the late middle period of what historians call the Vedic tradition. And as you can see there, the Vedic tradition is the ancient Indian religious tradition. It went from 1500 to 1100 BCE. That's before the Common Era, before the birth of Christ, okay? the primary texts of that religion are the Vedas and the Upanishads. And within the Upanishads is the Bhagavad Gita. So many of us are very familiar. I used to teach a course in the Bhagavad Gita, and I read the Bhagavad Gita every January. It's one of my favorite books of all time. The late Vedic period then went from 1100 to 500 BCE. So we're talking about a huge period of time of history to develop all of the stories and the rituals and the teachings of what we know as the Vedic tradition. One term that's used often in the late Vedic period is Brahmanism, was what the religion might have been called. And in Brahmanism gives a strong importance to the notion of absolute reality. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later. In 563 BC, so most people say, there are other dates, as I said, so from the Buddha is born, and then you see this sort of just the dates. I'm not going to read through them all, but he's born. His name is Siddhartha Gautama, and he was married. Then he leaves the palace. Then there's his renunciation. He gives up his life as a prince. Then there's his enlightenment. And then there's his first sermon, which supposedly happened in 528 BCE. And then he died in 483. So he lived a nice long life, taught for about 40 to 45 years, depending on the dates that we're looking at. And so you can see that this was overlapping with just the very tail end of the Vedic tradition. So he is, you know, as a result, he got trained, he was taught, he was a well-educated young man, and it was all in this Vedic tradition. So I'm saying all this because I think a lot of people are confused about the difference between the Vedic tradition, Buddhism, and Hinduism. So then Buddha comes and he creates his unique yoga, which we now call Buddhism. He would never have called it that, but and then we don't see the actual emergence of what was first called the Hindu synthesis and then classical Hinduism until 200 BC. So the Buddha has been dead for over 100 years. And then that period goes into the Common Era to 1200, to the year 1200. So I just wanted you to have a little bit of a historical framework to think about as we move through these notes that I have for you. So before I close out this page, I just want you to share with you the quotes of the day. Those of you who have been with me in my teaching over the last many years know, and those of you who have been at the times in the Orlando Insight group when I've led the meditation, I always start my classes with a quote of the day. I did that as a school teacher when I was teaching seventh grade years and years ago, and then I did it when I taught college, and I just keep doing it now. It's just kind of my thing. So here's two quotations that I think are good kind of pieces to resonate with some of the data that I'm going to give you here tonight. This first one is by a teacher, a scholar, whose name is Mary Rose O'Reilly, whose work I followed for many years when I was teaching English at Rollins. She says, somewhere there is a great mystery that wants to come live in your house and change everything. Somewhere there is a great mystery that wants to come in your house and change everything. Think about that as we begin talking about the young Buddha. And then the next one is from the poet Rumi, the Islamic poet Rumi. What you are seeking is seeking you. And if we can say anything about this talk that I'm going to give tonight, it is that he is a seeker. We see a man who is a profound, profound seeker. And So I thought that would be an appropriate quote. Okay, so I want to get us out of this. Let's see if I can do this now. I'm not quite sure. How do I do that, April? How do I get back to?
You should have a stop share somewhere.
Yeah, I know. I don't have it. Oh, wait a minute. Let me see if. There we go. Sorry. So sorry. Okay. I guess I did it by ending it.
No, I did it for you. Sorry.
Oh, you did? Okay. Thank you. It happened magically. That's why I wanted you here, April. Yeah.
The mystery.
yeah. Okay. Just a minute. Let me get. Got the timeline is done. I don't want to lose that. Hang on, bear with me, folks here. Everybody okay? Just trying to get my screen up here. Okay. Okay, so. Here we go. Now that you kind of have an idea about that, now we can kind of plunge into his life. And the first thing I want to do is give you a sense of the actual historical period that he came to us in. It was called the Axial Age, A-X-I-A-L, Axial Age. And that's a term that German philosopher Karl Jaspers used, and it refers to the period between the 8th century and the 3rd century BCE. So Jaspers called this Axial Age a turning point in human history, and it truly is, and you're going to see why it is in just a minute. He called it a turning point in human history. He said, during this time, most of the major religious and spiritual traditions emerged in Eurasian societies. So this means Iran and India, China, and most of the Greco-Roman world, which is a huge swath of territory, if you know your geography. And so what happened was, at this point in human history, all of these spiritual wisdom traditions were coming to the forefront of man's consciousness. So we had people like Confucius and Lao Tzu were living in China. All the schools of Chinese philosophy came into being. India produced the Upanishads and the Buddha. In Iran, a spiritual leader named Zarathustra taught of the struggle between good and evil. In Palestine, the prophets made their appearance from Elijah by way of Isaiah and Jeremiah to Deutero-Isaiah. Greece witnessed the appearance of Homer and the philosophers Heraclitus and Plato, among many other philosophers. And all of this happened. This is what is so mind-boggling, is that all of this happened at the same time. So again, just a minute, my computer just brought my email up in front of me. I have no idea why. So all of these people, as Jaspers explains in his book, which was called The Origin and Goal of History, all of these traditions were of these major figures through this wide part of Eurasia were coming to the forefront at the same time. So Jaspers also says that in addition to the uprising of spiritual interest in this period, that the period was marked by a really big shift in cognitive style. And as a teacher, I've been studying the Axial Age for quite a long time. And this was one of the concepts of it that was so interesting to me, because it was during this period that we saw a big shift from the cognitive processing, the sort of general cognitive processing that humans were using, which was a narrative and an analogical style to a much more analytical and reflective style, especially reflective meaning like thinking about thinking. Now, this doesn't seem like big time stuff to us because we're so accustomed to it. But in the Axial Age, people weren't thinking about their thinking. They were very concrete operational minds. And what you're beginning to see in this Axial Age, and this was a big influence on the Buddha, was people yearning for something. Go back to the Rumi quote, what you are seeking is seeking you. And this caused a much more reflective kind of mindset than we'd ever seen before among the sort of what we might call the thought leaders of the time. Now, there are going to be all kinds of reasons for this. I'm not going to try to go into the reasons because it would take us way down a rabbit hole that we don't need to go down tonight. But just think about it. Probably things like writing, lists, scriptures, all of these things were ways that people could communicate and kind of hold on to larger chunks of data, of information, and therefore they could think about it in a very different way. So all of this, according to scholars, enhanced the ability that human beings had to reflect on thoughts and challenge prior beliefs. So this shift in humans' ability to cognitively process their own thinking. Again, I know this sounds so normal to us, but you know, in 500 BC, it was not the normal way that human beings, they didn't ask like, well, why do you think that way? You know, that would not be a question they would have asked. It's highly significant though, that we begin to see certain of these major figures thinking in this way. And it's a major cause of the transformations that were taking place in the Axial Age. So this age is also defined as a period shifting from short-term materialistic orientation to long-term spiritual orientation. There was also a psychological shift in the Axial Age, and that refers to, according to Jaspers, the new ability of what he calls, quote, standing back and looking beyond. We'll come back to that in a little bit. So in her book, The History of God, this is such a fabulous book, you guys. Karen Armstrong is a beautiful writer and very accessible. The subtitle of her book is The 4,000-Year Quest of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So she speaks in this book of the Axial Age, and that I knew I had read this before. I knew I wanted to go back and read it to sort of give me a foundation for going into all of these other wisdom traditions. So in her book, The History of God, Karen Armstrong writes that the new ideologies of the Axial Age were basically an agreement that human life contained a transcendent element. I'm going to pause there just for a minute because I want that to soak in. So all of these different traditions, Taoism and Stoicism and the Greek philosophers and the prophets, we have this emerging notion that there was something within me as a human being. In other words, it wasn't just God, or it wasn't the shamans, or it wasn't the gurus of the period. It was me. I have the capacity to be transcendent. So the sages of this time interpreted this transcendence in very different ways, but they all saw a similar thing, and that was that it was a crucial development of men and women as full human beings, not just people who are nose to the grindstone, focusing only on survival, but human beings who had the capacity to think about themselves in a more transcendent way, in a new way. So think about this. It's pretty mind-blowing to me. that they, as these new, this new way of thinking about ourselves came about, the leaders, the thought leaders of the time, were helping people deal with this, this transcendence. They did not jettison other beliefs, other religions, other mythologies, but they just reinterpreted them and helped people rise above them. So again, I emphasize this because to me, it's just kind of mind blowing that most of the current religions that we know of today, that's going to be Buddhism, although Buddhism isn't really a religion, but I'm putting Buddhism in there. Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of those traditions that we know and people still practice today can trace their origins back to this time during the Axial Age. During this time, we see the rising of innovative, provocative, and disruptive thinkers who are still the source for present day religious, spiritual, philosophical, and psychological movements. Can you guys hear my dog barking? Oh, good. She's usually very quiet. She's up there barking like hell. So we've got religious, spiritual, philosophical, and psychological movements all being affected by these movements that were happening in the Axial Age. So you've got, I'm going to give you the names of some of these people who are carriers of wisdom: Socrates, Pythagoras, Buddha, Mahavira, Confucius, Lao Tzu, and the Hebrew prophets. The change these thinkers brought was the emergence of self-discipline and selflessness, which were, they seem very common to us today, but they were new at the time, and which today form the core of all world religions. So one of the things that I became very interested in as a first-year college student was the history of, I took courses in comparative religion because I was beginning to learn, I did not know this from my high school training, but I was beginning to learn that there are these common there's this perennial philosophy that runs its way through all of the major wisdom traditions. And that's what I began to commit my life to when I realized that. This period then constitutes a genuine transformation in human history because its thinkers have inspired so much of modern spirituality, philosophy, and psychology. So into this rich world that I've described for you, this Axial Age, this age of transformation, comes the baby boy, Siddhartha Gautama, a son of a wealthy and influential man living in a palace in the foothills of the Himalayas. Gautama enters the world in the later middle period of the Axial Age, born in 563 BCE, and comes to offer what Karen Armstrong calls, quote, autobiographical philosophy, drawing his conclusions and his teaching from his own experience and practice. Let's see how he got to this. I'm sure you've all heard the apocryphal story that Gautama was highly protected by his father, who did not want him to be exposed to the outside world. So I know the story goes that he sneaked out of the palace and he saw a dead man and he saw a sick man and he saw an old man. That probably didn't happen, although those experiences were coming to him by bits and pieces over his life. But anyway, he had this father who was very protective and wanted to keep him from being exposed to the outside world. And the reason is this: when the baby was born, he brought some Brahmins into the palace. Brahmins were spiritual teachers of the time, to examine the newborn baby and to tell his fortune. And they determined that he would see death and sickness, and this would cause him to become a renouncer. Now, a renouncer is a word that was used then as to denote people who had left the quote unquote real world of working and being in communities and they took off into the forests and into the mountains to seek spiritual truth. So these were people who left home and business and political life and all forms of normal life of the time to discover the spiritual truth that they were seeking. So this frightened the heck out of his father. And so the father sheltered him from the outside world. He lived in a beautiful place and he had, you know, no wants at all. He was given everything any young man could possibly want. He was well educated and he was being groomed to take a leadership role in the Republic of Sakha, that his father was also kind of some kind of political bigwig of that region of India. But the fact of the matter was, he was a virtual prisoner in his own house. Karen Armstrong comments that, quote, Gotama's pleasure palace is a striking image of a mind in denial. As long as we persist in closing our hearts to the sorrow that surrounds us on all sides, we remain incapable of growth and insight. So it is ironic that the very thing that he was innately seeking in his life was being kept from. Excuse me a minute here. I'm going to have to plug my computer in. So you know what happens when a parent has a great fear that a child is going to do something. You know what happens, right? They do it. Yeah, exactly. So the Brahmins made this pronouncement. And so, of course, as the story goes, Gotama was compelled to flee. It was almost an archetypal kind of thing that was going to happen. He would do what his father feared most and become a renouncer. When he looked at human life, he could see only the grim cycle of suffering, which began with the trauma of birth and proceeded inexorably toward aging, illness, death, sorrow, corruption, all of the awful things that happen to us in life, only to start again with the next cycle of life. He was convinced that these painful states must have their positive counterparts. Now, in my research, when I came to this concept in one of the Karen Armstrong books, I can't remember which one, but I thought, whoa, this was a new thing. And I think that's what I'm wanting to impress upon you mostly in the research that I've done, is that I began to see the actual teachings of the Buddha as they were emerging in his mind very early on in his life. It's kind of mind-blowing, really. Suppose, he said, when he came up with this notion of positive, he's thinking about these painful states, and then he comes up with this thought that there must be positive counterparts to all of this pain and suffering. And here's the quote from the from one of the discourses, the Buddha's discourses. He says, quote, suppose I start looking for the unborn, the unaging, the deathless, the sorrowless, the incorrupt, the supreme freedom from all of this bondage. Suppose I start looking for that, he began to ask himself. Here we see Gotama had allowed the knowledge of dukkha to invade his life, and his quest was beginning very early. But eventually, much later, after these small thoughts were beginning to emerge in his consciousness, in the middle of the night, at the age of 29, he left his father's house, turned away from the leadership role he was destined to fill, and away from the loving wife and baby son that had just been born, and took off on his trusted horse to seek the truth. So I want to say that one of the books, this book is a biography of, this is Thich Nhat Hanh's story. It's called Walking in the Footsteps of the Buddha. I read all of this with a tremendously large grain of salt because this is Thich Nhat Hanh waxing poetic as he always did, as was his way. And he makes this life of the Buddha quite romantic and beautiful. And he talks about how, what great love there was. It's interesting, and I don't doubt that it's true, but it's not something that we've come to think about of the Buddha. But he was very much in love. He was very much in habit. He had learned a lot from his wife, but he was so driven to find out what this mystery was that wanted to come into his house, meaning his heart, and change everything. He wanted to change it for himself, and he wanted to change it for all sentient beings, as we'll come to see. So he left. When he left, he gave up his horse. Eventually, his trusted attendant took the horse back after he got to a certain point in his travels. He gave up his jewels. He gave up his fine clothing. And he took on the ragged robes of a dead person. And he began walking. He began, you know, just going through villages and going through forests and leading the wandering life of a mendicant, of a seeker, of a renouncer. The first thing he did as he set off on this journey of finding the truth was he was looking for a teacher, and he found two teachers early on. Alara Kalama was one, and Udalaka Ramaputta, don't expect you to know those names, but those were the two teachers he started with. And I think he was probably with multiple teachers, but I didn't dig enough to find out exactly what the trajectory of different teachers was. But he learned a lot. He studied a lot. He practiced a lot. He was an excellent student. He reached high states of concentration and trance very quickly. But he became eventually very dissatisfied with the teaching he was getting. And remember, it's the Vedic tradition that he's being taught. Hinduism didn't exist, and of course, Buddhism didn't exist. He became very dissatisfied with these teachings because he said when he returned from these altered states, he was evidently very adept at reaching high levels of concentration and meditation very quickly. He said, when I came out of these states, I was still my unregenerate, greedy, yearning self. I thought that was funny to hear the person who would become the Buddha talk about himself as a greedy, unregenerate self. He said, the trance I experienced was not Nibbana, meaning that's the Sanskrit word for nirvana, okay, which is ultimate awakening in the Vedic tradition. So he says these trances were not Nibbana because Nibbana cannot be temporary. So we see two things happening with the Buddha right off the bat. First of all, highly skilled at concentration practice, and secondly, becoming very astute about the concept of impermanence. Nibbana cannot be an impermanent state. So we go on. After years of study and practice, he left multiple teachers, seeing as he did that the formal instruction in the Vedic tradition was an ineffective path to find the truth that he so desperately sought. Now, an interesting thing happens at this point, and I wish I could tell you the years. I don't even know how many years of studying and traveling and meditating under trees in the woods went on. Some people say it was 4 years. Some people say it was 9 years. Most people say it was around 5 or 6 years. So I'm not sure how long that actual teaching, you know, working with a teacher went on, but it was quite a long time because he worked in depth with several teachers. But when he gave up the teaching, knowing that the Vedic tradition was not going to give him what he wanted, he was undeterred. Here's the thing that I think is interesting, is that he turned to a group of ascetics. Now, asceticism was a very common lifestyle for certain kind of people in this time period. And it was characterized by abstinence from sensual pleasures, often for the purpose of pursuing some kind of spiritual tradition or some kind of spiritual goal. The ascetics were known to have a very frugal lifestyle. They were renunciates of all material possessions and physical pleasures. And they also did ridiculous amounts of fasting while concentrating on the practice of religion or reflection on spiritual matters, along with other kind of physical abusive things like whipping themselves or walking on hot coals or, you know, just abusing their bodies. The ascetics were not a fun group to hang out with, as I read it. But the Buddha stayed with this tradition, the ascetic tradition, for several years. But in the end, he became very, very ill, almost to the point of death. He was starving himself. And at some point, he realized, oh my gosh, I don't think he said that, but that's kind of what I felt like in reading about that. There was this moment where he thought, I'm not getting what I need here. I wanted to find peace and liberation. And instead what I'm finding is, you know, coming close to death. So undeterred by finding yet another false path, he did not give up. Henceforth, he would rely only on his own insights. And as we come to see, his teachings and practices were ultimately based on his own lived experience, what, as I said earlier, Karen Armstrong called autobiographical philosophy. This became one of the central tenets of his spiritual method. He drilled into his disciples that they must not accept anybody's teaching, no matter how august the teacher was, if those teachings did not tally with their own experience. They were to take no doctrine on faith. Now, at this point, right before he actually leaves the ascetic tradition, he has a childhood memory. And it's the story of the apple tree, which I will repeat this. I don't know that it might be an apocryphal story too, but I don't think so, since he does refer to it in the discourses. But it's a memory. So now imagine, he's very sick. He's realizing this is not the path. He's not going to find the truth that he wants. And he has this memory of this being a child of 6 years of age, sitting under a rose apple tree and watching the ceremonial plowing of the fields before the first spring planting. This was something that took place every spring. There would be a big festival that would take place. Everybody would come together and all the princes and kings would come out and there would be food to eat for everybody. This was before the fields were to be plowed up. He was sitting under this apple tree watching the plows work, and he noticed all of these young shoots and insects and tiny creatures that were being plowed up and killed as the plowing happened, and he was overcome with a deep grief. As he recalls it in the teachings, he says, a surge of selfless empathy brought him to a moment of spiritual release. Pure joy welled up within him, and he took a yogic seated position and entered a trance state. That's unquote. That's a direct quote from the discourses. As Gautama recalled this moment, he said he realized that the joy he felt was entirely free of craving and greed. And he asked, could this be the way to enlightenment? He began to think that this feeling of liberation that he had as a six-year-old child was built into the structure of our humanity. I want to talk more about that, but I'm mindful of the time, so I'm not going to distract myself here, but we might at some point come back to that. It was at this point of recalling his memory under the apple tree that he understood that starving his body into submission was not the way to find what he sought, and he should cultivate these innate tendencies that lead to liberation, the release of the mind. So I want to reiterate this. Those of you that have studied with me before know how often I talk about the innate qualities that exist within us. This is where I got this idea. I got it from the Buddha. It's so powerful, I think. And I do hope we have time at some point, maybe not tonight, to come back to talk about that. So, but as I've said before, what I'm wanting you to see is that we're seeing the core teachings of the Buddha emerging in his consciousness even before he's reached enlightenment. And this was a new understanding for me, because I really thought he was enlightened, and then after he was enlightened, he created all of these teachings. Not so. The teachings were emerging as far back as when he was 6 years old. So you might think of the joy that he experienced in the trance that he had underneath the apple tree as one of the seven factors of awakening, which we've talked about in this group before, and which he eventually taught to all of his teachers. Other key factors of his teaching taking place in these early years before enlightenment, he realized that the unhelpful states of mind must be balanced by their positive counterparts. We've mentioned that already. Instead of merely avoiding aggression, he must behave gently and kindly to everything and everybody and cultivate thoughts of loving kindness. The tenets of Buddhism were beginning to take shape in his mind. He knew it was important not to lie, but also crucial to be reasoned, accurate, clear, and beneficial. He committed to work with his human nature, not against it, as was taught in the Vedic tradition. So he determined to work with his human nature, to understand it, to accept it, and not fight against it. So you can see right there the framework of Buddhist psychology taking place. So I'm going to list real quickly some of the big developments that took place as he left he dropped the ascetic life. And he took food, and as he was being nursed back to health, he began to develop his own yoga. Now, remember, when we're talking about yoga, we're talking about really the capacity to meditate and get to these higher states of consciousness. So I've got 8 that I want to share with you just real quickly. I'm not going to try to elaborate on them because that's kind of what we do every week in the Sangha. We come together to talk about one or several of these concepts. But let me just mention here what we're seeing the Buddha thinking about and trying to give shape to in his own mind, even prior to his own enlightenment. The first one is mindfulness, the preeminent major feature of the Buddhist tradition. He scrutinized his behavior at every moment of the day, noting feelings and sensations and the fluctuations of his consciousness, watching the constant stream of desires, irritation, and ideas that course through his mind in the space of a single hour. He became acquainted with the workings of his own mind. So this is what we say over and over and over as we go into meditation. What we're trying to do in our meditative practice is to become familiar with the workings of our own mind. He noticed the way, this is number 2, he noticed the way that one craving after another took possession of his mind and heart, how he was ceaselessly yearning to become something else, to go somewhere else, to get something he did not have. So there we see this second noble truth. The causes of suffering are craving and clinging, wanting to be something you're not, wanting to go someplace you are not, wanting to have something you don't have. The third part of his own unique yoga was that he noticed the way everything changes and how suffering arises from our wanting things to stay as they are. So here we, again, as I've mentioned before, we see the concept of impermanence rising up in his mind. Number 4, he continued to practice yoga diligently. In other words, the discipline of daily meditation was the foundation of his life. He shifted his desires to wanting the welfare of all living things. So selflessness is a major concept of the Buddhist tradition. And he cultivated a mind that is lucid, conscious of itself, and completely alert. Number seven, he shunned his debilitating doubt and sought to be calm and still. And number eight, every day while practicing yoga, he entered into alternative states of consciousness, fusing each successive trance with a feeling of positive benevolence toward the whole world. These meditations he called the immeasurables, which we've talked about at length before in other sessions. So I have a whole section on the immeasurables. I'm going to skip right over that for the purpose of time here, too much to cover. So it seems we have, interestingly, no idea how long it took for Gautama to recover his health and to attain supreme enlightenment, although it did take a long time, but he had many people coming to him. He had friends and he had young people that he was seemed to be surrounded all of his life, all of his explorations in the wilderness by young people. And these people took care of him and brought him back to health. And we see in this time period in which he was coming back to health that the primary teachings of his new form of yoga were taking shape, and that he was convinced that the harmful ascetic tradition and the ravages of that practice were not the way to go. He was, as I said, developing his own form of yoga, no longer hoping to discover his eternal self, as the Vedic traditions taught him. He saw this eternal self as another delusion that held people back from enlightenment. And he also realized that every sentient being was in a state of constant flux and merely a succession of temporary, mutable states of existence. So non-self beginning to form here. He was coming to see that there was no permanent sense of self that could be found. His yoga was designed to acquaint him with his own human nature, his own psychology, his own fluctuating state of existence. As he became aware of the ephemeral nature of his invasive thoughts, it became difficult for him to identify with them. And he became increasingly adept at monitoring the distractions that deprived him of peace. So, according to Karen Armstrong, the Gautama's enlightenment was, she says, almost certainly no instant born again experience. And that's what the story we get is, that he says in a point of frustration, he says, I'm going to sit down under this tree and I'm not going to get up until I'm enlightened. And bam, that's what happened. But she says, highly unlikely that it went that way. One of the things that we do know that I can add here is, and I don't know which discourse this is from, but from one of his discourses, he says, in this method that I'm teaching you, in this method, training, discipline, and practice take effect by slow degrees with no sudden persistence, perception of the ultimate truth. So the Buddha himself recognized that this was a long and slow process. So the single moment of enlightenment under the Bodhi tree is a nice story, but it probably didn't happen. But surely, nevertheless, if slowly, Gautama did tamp down the unbeneficial states of his own mind and achieved peace, the peace of complete selflessness. Henceforth, he would be called the Buddha or the Awakened One. And he had found an inner haven which enabled him and any man or woman who put this regimen into practice to live with pain, to take possession of it, to affirm it, and experience a profound serenity in the midst of that suffering. He never claimed to do away with suffering. What he offered was a capacity to live with it peacefully and react to it compassionately. Okay, I'm going to skip over some really good material here, but I want to give us time for a little conversation. So as the story goes, then the seeker known as Gotama sat himself down under the Bodhi tree, determined not to get up until he had the truth. And so it happened. He fought off the temptations of Mara and he achieved ultimate truth, becoming the awakened one. The Buddha continued to sit after his enlightenment, meditating under the Bodhi tree and then standing beside it for a number of weeks, so the story goes. 7 weeks after his enlightenment, he left his seat under the tree and decided to teach others what he had learned, encouraging people to follow a path that he called the middle way, which is one of balance rather than extremism. And for the next 45 years of his life, that's what the Buddha did. He was now called And the Buddha, as he was now called, traveled through cities and towns of the Ganges Plain, bringing his teachings with him. And as I said earlier, before the meditation, the very first teaching that he gave after his enlightenment, when he sought out his followers, who had rejected him, by the way, because they felt that when he gave up his, he started eating food, he was showing a lack of discipline and focus, and they fled from him because they thought he was not the real deal. But the first thing he did was he went off to find his followers. And the very first teaching he gave to his followers was the Four Noble Truths. We all know them. Let me say them again, though. Life is suffering, noble truth number one. Noble truth number two, the cause of suffering is craving and clinging and attachment. Noble truth number three is good news. There's a way out of the suffering. There's a way to free yourself from the craving and clinging. And noble truth number four is the way out, the Eightfold Normal Path. So in the next few weeks, you are going to be lucky enough to hear from April and Allie and Lily, who will be guiding us in an exploration of the first three noble truths. And then further down the line, we're going to be talking about the Eightfold Path. But first, we want to get those first three noble truths down. His very first teaching, the first and most important teaching that he probably did. Let me see if there's something else. Just to kind of conclude here, in his early teachings, then he was beginning to train his disciples in the four foundations of mindfulness and to deal with the throngs of people that were coming to him. They traveled a lot. They also sort of set up house in various groves and parks, and throngs of people came to him in these groves. It was sort of like the Axial Ages version of Woodstock was the impression I got. And so he set about creating this curriculum that eventually has emerged into all of the discourses that he has given to us, thankfully. Okay, so much more to say. Always my tendency, I did this for years and years as a teacher, I always had way more material than I could cover in one class period, but I'm gonna stop there and I'm gonna see if we can spend a few moments here answering questions or getting your comments or your thoughts or your insights that you've had from the little bit of history that I've shared with you. Anybody want to? Oh, let me just start with a question to get you started. Is anybody else kind of surprised to, or maybe you guys already knew this, this might be a weakness in my own training. I'm curious to know if anybody was kind of surprised to see that these major teachings that we think of as being the foundation of his curriculum were really emerging much, much before this point of enlightenment. Is that kind of a new idea for anybody, or is that just me that it was new for?
I honestly hadn't thought of it till tonight.
Yeah.
But I think when you think about that and then the history lesson you gave us about what was happening at the time, it makes sense.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Because there was a lot happening everywhere. And while, you know, it took much longer to travel and for ideas and thoughts, ideas and cultural influences to travel then than it does now, it still traveled.
It did. Exactly.
You know, so there were influences that were happening amongst various different cultures, very similar to each other. And he's being raised in this, even though he was being protected by his father. So yeah. It makes you think that just given this time, and if the father was self-aware enough to know that I didn't want my son having to deal with the awfulness of life, then the father may well have been a learned man.
Yeah, he was a learned man. And I think you're absolutely onto something, Susan, because I've thought about this so often in my reading that there's something that happens. There's an ethos of a period, you know, and there's some sort of energetic energy that comes together, you know, and impresses itself upon us. It's like, I go back to that Rumi phrase that I started with, what you are seeking is seeking you. So there is this sort of transcendence emerging in the consciousness of human beings at this time in our history as a species. And it's like, all of you are too young to probably remember the Arthur C. Clarke book and the movie. I can't remember the name of it now. Anyway, it talks about this idea of, the idea is kind of, bam, come into history, you know, without any explanation for how they came about. April, you're our anthropologist or anthropology, right?
Anthropology. Yeah.
But that's a notion you study in anthropology too, isn't it? That there are these phenomena that happen seemingly in very disparate parts of the world that this knowledge comes to us.
Yeah, exactly.
By magic, almost.
Yeah, and I've actually heard recently, I was listening to a podcast where they were even just talking, they were taking it further, like, you know, if Einstein hadn't been the one, you know, someone else within that.
Exactly. Same, yes.
So when it comes down to it, it's not even so much which actual individual, because it is this kind of gestalt or whatever, this like thing that's in a more organic way that also, I think even when you're talking about the innate quality, so I think it's also kind of like, you know, what is coming first, right? Like, there is this thing that's a part of our nature. And then the human mind at that time was beginning to discover how to describe it and how to understand, or, you know, how to talk about it, right? But it was already there.
There, absolutely. And I think that's what's so beautiful about the rose apple tree, is that that was his insight when he was thinking back onto that memory, that feeling of well-being that I had came up out of nowhere. It just happened. It came through me. And that's a really major tenet of the Buddhist tradition. So I had so much fun doing the reading for this. And I don't know if Peter will want to publish my notes, but I have more information in there that might be interesting to some of you. And we'll see if he wants to use them on the website. Is there a question?
Yeah.
Comment that Sharon, is that you? Sharon.
You first of all, congratulations on using Karen Armstrong for your main organizational information, because she's well known as a scholar in publishing modern whatever you want to call it explanations of the different religions. You had me thinking a lot, because I haven't really thought about this. So I'm thinking in terms of geographics, the geographical time, as well as the centuries, what you're saying, 5th century. And then, of course, in the 6th century, there was Muhammad, I mean, the you know, the in the Middle East, developing that region, which is not all that far from, well, Nepal's a little trek, but they had this, maybe they still were traveling the Silk Roads and the, I really don't know. I'm thinking about the geographical range of the Buddha. The Ganges, you know, the Indian subcontinent and then up into Nepal. And I'm also thinking in terms of, you know, if you want to go into the Christianity and that whole region in Asia, where things were really evolving. And I just had not given it that kind of thought. So you've really kind of stimulated some of the ideas of...
It's really fascinating. I agree. It's very interesting. A good place to start would be, a shorter book, The History of God. That's a really good place to start. But this one, The Great Transformation, The Beginning of Religious Traditions, this book is, it's such a good read. And she's so accessible. It's not like you're reading a stuffy scholar. She's a scholar, but...
Exactly.
She's a very readable writer. So I highly recommend that.
Leslie, actually, if you put all that in the notes, I am going to put your notes up with the talk.
Oh, okay, good. I have at the end of the notes, I have a list. I went back through all of my comments and I made a list of the core Buddhist teachings that were emerging, and I just have a list. And for me, I'm a list maker. I take after the Buddha in that way. And it was just interesting to see how much of his intellectual and spiritual tradition was you're seeing take form in these various stories of his life. It was really fascinating for me. And then, you guys, what's really cool is that you're I think Allie is going to do the first Noble Truth next week, right?
That's me. Yes.
Yeah. So I hope I've set you up good to begin to really take a deep dive into this whole notion of suffering. And you can see that his temperament was from the age of 6 years old. He had this little heart that was so precious and so open. And you know, one of the core concepts that we see through this early part of his life too is his commitment to relieving the suffering of all sentient beings, not just human beings, all sentient beings, even the worms and the little bunnies and the shoots of grass that were being torn up as the fields were being plowed. So you're going to have fun. We'll look forward to that. Allie, we've got just a few more minutes here. Is there any other comment that somebody would like to make or question?
If nobody else, somebody, okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say that I had a lot of thoughts about childhood, because we, and I'm older, and I look at children today and how structured and protected they are, and how, and of course he was supposedly sheltered himself, but I think being in touch with nature, being out in nature, is one way to stimulate. And I'm not talking about a structured day in the park. I'm talking about really doing the kinds of things out that are free form. And we don't, modern children, do they have that opportunity in our culture? I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah, that's a good topic, but probably not one we can.
Not.
So I wanted to get to Steve before we close out. Did you have a comment, Steve?
Yeah. Hey, Leslie. Thanks for the talk tonight, and also a few weeks ago on 4,000 weeks.
Oh yeah.
On that one, I haven't even had a chance to read that because my my father hijacked the book, and I'm not sure how useful it is to him, but he's quoted a little bit out of it. And he's just turning 100 in just another couple days.
That book is applicable to of all ages. That's what I loved about it. Yeah.
But in all the discussion today, you know, I just think, boy, wouldn't it have been interesting if the Buddha or any of these scholars would have had an opportunity to see what it's like to be in a society that's just so burdened with messages about messages that are just so diverse and with so much confusion to so many.
Yeah.
And how different that is versus even what we had just years ago.
Yes.
Growing up ourselves.
Yes. I think that's so true. So true.
Anyway, thanks for the talk tonight, Leslie.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Steve. Thank you for joining. Well, I feel like I was a little bit geeky tonight, geeking out on history stuff, but I loved doing it, and I love sharing it with you, and I hope you all will come back next week for Ali's talk on the first noble truth: life is suffering. There's much, much more to be said about that. Okay, guys, have a great rest of the week. I look forward to seeing you again soon. Take care.
Leslie.
Thank you. It was wonderful, Leslie.
Oh, thank you. Bye.